Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. Another busy week, including some stats on the U.S. employment picture. Labor Department coming out saying that job openings rose to 11 million in the month of October. That, Tim, is the second highest total on record. And keep in mind, this is against a backdrop of more than 24 million Americans quitting their jobs from April to September in what's been called the Great Resignation. It's something you and I talk about so much. That story, by the way, a Bloomberg Big Take, also featured in the magazine this week.
Yeah, a really good one. We're going to do a deep dive in just a few minutes. In the meantime, today's changing labor market, a major outcome of the pandemic. It's affecting the economy in a lot of different ways, Carol. It's something that we talked about with Carlyle Group co-founder and co-chairman David Rubenstein.
I like to think of him as an elder statesman. Not just it's an age thing, but he's just seen so many different market cycles, economic pictures. He's worked in the public sector, in the Carter administration, understands obviously the investment world and the private sector. So always love getting some time with him.
Plus, venture capitalist and AOL founder Steve Case and AppHarvest president David Lee talk all about building sustainable brands. Carol, this is from a panel that you did this week.
Yeah.
In keeping with that, our Bloomberg Business Week investigations team also examines the ESG ratings industry through the lens of the rating agency heavyweight MSCI, and its findings cast harsh light on what ESG investing actually means.
All of that to come. We begin with this week's cover story. It's also a Bloomberg Big Take, one of our most read stories on the terminal as well this week. It's about scientists looking for a super vaccine to beat Delta, Omicron, and all those variants.
Bloomberg News healthcare reporter Bob Langrith wrote it. He joined us along with Bloomberg Businessweek editor Joel Weber.
What we're ultimately talking about here isn't about just a booster or even anything that's specifically about COVID, although it could solve it. But there is a very, very, very early science that suggests that we could actually be able to develop something that looks like a pan coronavirus. So that would account for not just COVID, but remember MERS, remember SARS, even the common cold. And again, let me underscore this, early science. And if this plays out a little bit, though, knowing what we know now about being able to develop vaccines, it might not be so much that the science would be the thing that would hold us back so much as the economics of it all, right? So Bob, take us to Singapore, where the science, part of the science, is coming from.
Yeah, so we begin the story with a lead of one of the world's top bat coronavirus experts. A guy named Lin Fei Wang in Singapore has been studying bat-borne viruses for decades, and one that led the team that discovered that SARS, that was that one of the coronavirus deadly coronavirus epidemic in 2003. He discovered that came from bats, and so when the the pandemic started to happen. Early on, he had this idea that maybe some of these SARS survivors in Singapore had some kind of special antibodies that they could protect against COVID. So I looked at them, it turns out they didn't. But then about a year later, you know, those survivors in Singapore, the original SARS, you know, started getting immunizations for COVID. And he had this idea, like, now they've kind of, this is this rare window into immune systems that have been exposed to two of these different, you know, epidemic strains of coronaviruses. And do they have some special cross-reactive antibodies? And he looked again, and they did. They had antibodies protected against, like, five different coronaviruses that had never been in humans before.
Feels like a holy grail, almost.
Yeah, so that was one of the first signs that, like, this sort of thing might be possible. And he and about, you know, 10, 12, 13 other labs and a bunch of smaller biotechs are, you know, racing to work on this. But, you know, long term, the key question is if this continues to look promising, who's going to put up the money to do it, for the big kind of Manhattan Project to do it?
You know, here we are with the Omicron variant making its way around the world, and the executives of these companies are being asked, are you working already on an Omicron variant shot? If they're giving us some sort of shot every 6 months to attack a new variant, that's money in their pockets. So incentives aren't necessarily aligned with them creating this shot to end all shots.
Oh, right. They have a thing, you know, that works right now, and they have a kind of a procedure they know that's probably going to work to make something for a new variant, at least for, you know, we don't know how long these things are going to work. That's one thing. And then if new variants keep coming, you know, even with mRNA, which is faster than other vaccine technologies, you're still scrambling to keep up. You still got a virus that races ahead of things. So, you know, so the riskier thing, but it could pay off, would be to put in a lot of money, a big Manhattan-style research project by someone to see if this universal thing is really possible. But someone has to put big bucks behind it if the research continues to be promising.
Well, the other thing here is, like, there's big bucks, and there's some of that, right? NIH has put some of that in there. But there's even, like, potentially different technologies, right? Like, we've all come to understand mRNA is one thing, but nanoparticles?
Yeah, so that's one of the new ones.
Blew my mind, Bob. Tell me more.
Yeah, that's like the next generation, like, vaccines. So the idea behind these nanoparticle vaccines, which is one of the main technologies they're pursuing for kind of pan or coronavirus shots, is that you have a little kind of virus-sized particle. It's either some sort of bacterial or kind of artificial protein, and you could sort of add on little different spike proteins or surface proteins from different coronaviruses kind of all over the top. So it looks like to the immune system, it looks like a virus with pieces of 10 different coronaviruses on top. And that, in theory, might train the immune system to kind of generate cross-reactive antibodies against multiple coronaviruses. And that's what they're showing in these lab experiments, and it's mostly lab experiments. There's a few phase one human trials, but not many. That's what they're showing that may be happening in some of these early experiments. And yeah, so it's very intriguing.
That was Bloomberg News healthcare reporter Bob Langrith, along with Business Week editor Joel Weber.
Coming up, the pandemic has roiled the global travel industry for more than a year and a half. You know that. And the emergence of the Omicron variant, not helping things out right now.
Yeah, Trivago CEO Axel Hefer joined us on when businesses might finally turn the corner. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Yeah, it's not easy to be a global travel and hospitality company during the pandemic, and the emergence of yet another coronavirus variant, it's only adding to the uncertainty and volatility within the industry.
Airlines, cruise lines, hotels, the services we used to book them also taking a major hit for the last 18 months. Our next guest, well, he's right in the middle of it.
That is so true. And we've seen the stocks kind of move back and forth, sometimes rallying, sometimes taking a hit as a result of the news to do with the virus. You mentioned the executive right in the middle of it. We're talking about Axel Hefer. He's CEO of the booking platform Trivago. He caught up with us from his home base in Germany to talk about the latest hurdles brought on by COVID and when he expects, fingers crossed, things to pick up.
The situation got a lot worse, and particularly in some of our core markets in Europe, with infections on record highs in Germany and in many other markets. On the other hand, we continue to believe that the outlook and the spring will be very, very strong, and that we will be through the pandemic more or less by mid of next summer. So right now, very tough and sometimes also a bit depressing, but the outlook's still very positive.
Well, in terms of outlooks, in the earnings report that you reported back in November, on November 1st, Trivago said that it does not expect a full rebound in travel over the winter. When do you expect a full rebound in travel?
I do think that we will see a very strong spring. I mean, like this year, and also last year, we've seen that coming out of a winter with high infections, with restrictions in many places, people want to travel and want to actually see friends and family, want to get out and get a break. And we expect exactly the same pattern. Having said that, what will be different from our perspective in 2022 versus 21, and for sure obviously 2020, is that there is a significantly greater number of people vaccinated twice or even three times. And to be honest, also a significantly greater number of people that got sick already and have antibodies because of that.
One thing I wanted to go back to is the Thanksgiving weekend. How did that go for you guys? And is that an indicator of maybe what we'll see through the rest of the winter season?
I mean, it went well. And the U.S. overall is still much, much more stable than Europe, to be honest. And there is one very big benefit in being in the U.S. You don't have to worry that much about travel restrictions being imposed between states, which is a problem in Europe and is something that adds a lot of uncertainty to your travel plans. There's a regular flow of new restrictions, change in restrictions, testing requirements, etc. And this friction is what is concerning people and holding them off from traveling. In terms of looking forward, it is very, very difficult to say. The new variant is obviously adding uncertainty. And like in the past, some governments think that you can stop a virus from entering the country by imposing very strict travel restrictions, which obviously only works for so long.
It sounds like you disagree with that assessment.
It's very difficult to say, to be honest, and I don't want to be a politician in times like we are in today, but it works to slow down the spread of a virus, which in particular in winter can make sense if your hospitals are full already. But the general idea of locking out a virus in today's world and in the global economy that we're living in is just theoretical. And, you know, every new virus variant will make it eventually to every single country.
Hey, Axel, tell us about the thing you're doing, the partnership with Huawei. It's a strategic partnership. What is that all about?
Yeah, it's actually very interesting. So Huawei is building basically their own ecosystem with Harmony OS and their own services. And the most important services from our perspective are obviously Search, Petal Search, and Petal Maps. And we are partnering with them to help them to bring similar services to their customers that exist already on other search engines like Bing or Google, leveraging our supply of hotels worldwide.
I'm curious about why Huawei. I mean, anyone who listens to our program regularly or follows the news knows that Huawei has been under scrutiny by governments around the world and certainly engaged in a spat with the U.S. government. So take us into your thinking here.
I mean, we are interested in basically helping every search engine to compete more effectively with Google, and we are also in discussions with others. But it's for sure one of the big search engines that is up and rising, given that they have a huge installed base of devices that will be powered by their new search over the next years.
In the break, Tim and I were talking, and I'm saying that sometimes I just get overwhelmed by the amount of travel platforms that are out there. And so how do you, and truth be told, I am now looking for ease and platforms that are really clear. So how do you think about how you want to evolve so that you can catch your users' attention or more users' attentions?
So you're absolutely right. I mean, we are in a situation where there are too many platforms, and in particular in the pandemic, we've seen that size matters a lot. And it doesn't only matter in terms of economics, but also in terms of quality of service, because the more users you are having on your platform, the better your data is and the better your product is. And so what we started to do, and the Huawei partnership is one of the first partnerships in that direction, is we started to develop business-to-business solutions where we help actually other companies to serve their customers better by accessing our back-end services and basically benefiting from our size and our scale for their own benefit.
Axel, because Trivago offers people who use the service weekend stays, cars, flights, packages, you have this unique insight into how people are feeling and booking at any given moment. I did want to ask you just about what you're seeing on the platform. in real time right now, because this is a global platform. You serve customers and get revenue from the US, from Germany, from Brazil, Australia, the UK. What can you tell us about what people are doing on the platform right now that does or does not reflect any sort of trepidation about Omicron?
Yeah, so the U.S. is relatively speaking stable, to be honest. So there is not that much concern about the new variant yet. Europe has been hit by a combination of really increase in Delta cases, a significant increase in Delta cases, and concerns about the new variant spreading. And then in Asia, you see a decline in overall activity, predominantly coming through through the new variant. So it's a bit a mixed bag, as you would expect across the globe. But generally speaking, people are nervous, and they are nervous about making travel plans because they have seen in the past that any new variant is likely to lead to travel restrictions at some point in time.
That was Trivago CEO Axel Hefer.
Still ahead on Bloomberg Business Week, the cost of Christmas in 2021.
That's right. What might those nine ladies dancing, seven swans a-swimming, six geese a-laying, and of course, those five golden rings, what are they going to cost this year?
I believe, Tim, you have to say, five golden rings.
Nah, you got to sing it.
I'm also partial to the Ten Lords a-leaping. Labor an issue on that one, that's for sure. That's all coming up next. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
So 12 days of Christmas, we're just going to put that out there. What would it maybe cost us this year? It's definitely, it often goes up from year to year, and safe to say it's going to go up this year.
Yeah, we got the latest CPI numbers this past Friday, and rising prices are proving to be stickier than many had hoped for. And those higher costs, well, they can really affect people's holiday spending patterns.
And with all the supply chain snarls we've been covering, we don't even know if we're going to be able to get everything we want anyway.
To help us build out our holiday budget for 2021, we caught up with the Chief Investment Officer of PNC Asset Management Group, Amanda Agati. She joined us to help break down the 38th and most expensive installment of the PNC Christmas Price Index. See, it's still CPI, but Christmas Price Index, right?
Five golden rings.
The 12 days of Christmas, the traditional holiday song, is really the basket of goods and services that we use to price for our annual Christmas Price Index. It's literally that simple. We add up the cost for one partridge in a pear tree, two turtle doves, and so on as the song goes.
Okay, well, this year it's going to cost you tens of thousands of dollars. $41,205.58.
That's correct. To buy all 12 days worth of True Love's gifts, that's about what it's going to cost. It's about 5.7% in terms of an increase relative to 2019 levels. We're comparing versus 2019 because such an unprecedented year in 2020. We actually had to remove a number of big components of the index, and so we thought a better comparison was really to compare versus 2019. If you really want to make an impression, though, out there, and buy all 364 gifts, that's repeating all the verses of the song, you're really going to have to shell out a lot. It's a little over $179,000 this year.
All right. So what? We've got inflation at this point, already at a 30-year high in the U.S., could approach 7% soon. That's based on a Bloomberg story. So we're just a little bit below inflation, right, in terms of the increase from 2019 to 2021?
A little bit below, but pretty darn close. I think it's a very special basket of goods and services. So sometimes we can glean insights relative to what's happening in the broader economy. But this is a pretty unique basket. So not surprised at all to see the prices up, but it is a little bit more nuanced than what we're seeing in the broader economy.
Well, here's what's so interesting, because you do have six geese a-laying, and Carol's like trying to keep a straight face and not laugh right into the microphone as I'm saying that and not singing it. But that's higher this year by 57.1% versus last year.
Lot.
But then it's really interesting because you have things like, what is it? Nine ladies dancing, the price remaining the same. And the point that you're trying to make is that live performances were out of the 2020 Christmas price index. because of the pandemic, but the price hasn't actually changed since 2019. Is that supply or is that demand when it comes to live performances?
There's a number of things going in there. So last year we had to take this unprecedented step of taking all of the live performances out of the index. And so the index fell 59%. And so this year, thankfully, with the progress around the reopening, bringing live performances back, we were able to incorporate them into the index. But I think a number of, you know, theater companies and dance companies, while certainly wanting to make up for lost time, also don't want to push their audiences away by jacking prices up really significantly. And so it is a bit of a fine balance, and it is a little bit nuanced here. And so while the ladies dancing didn't move all that much in terms of pricing, we did see some movement in terms of the lords and in terms of the pipers and the drummers. And so, again, you really have to look under the hood to see what each variable is doing.
What's the biggest one? Is it the geese laying?
The biggest move is actually the six geese laying, but I would say the largest increases by far are really what we consider to be the exotic pet category.
I'm just going to tell you, that is my favorite thing said all year, but go ahead.
Well, I'm glad to be
holding
that award there for you. Really, when it comes down to it, at least when it comes to the birds, we're seeing higher food prices, certainly higher labor and wage-related prices. Those both apply more broadly across the economy, and so that is driving up the increased costs of raising the birds. But I would also say, so that's a supply side thing, but on the demand side, we're actually seeing pretty significant demand there. Accelerating trends continuing around backyard farming, believe it or not, and even farm to tables. In the bird category, they're really getting it from both sides.
That was Amanda Gotti. She's the CIO of PNC Asset Management Group.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up next, the fallout from what's been deemed the Great Resignation. We're losing workers faster than we can hire them. This is younger generations are rethinking the pursuit of wealth.
This does feel like a sea change when it comes to the labor market. We're going to break down the state of America's labor force, also talk about where to find our next generation of innovators, and so much more. We're going to do that with Carlyle Group co-founder David Rubenstein. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
There is an unstoppable force that exists with humans, which is humans want to interact with humans. And that isn't just for a vacation. Humans need to and want to interact on business, to build partnerships, to innovate, to build culture, and they want to congregate.
All right, so that was Hilton Worldwide President and CEO Chris Nassetta talking with our next guest, who is not worried about the likes of Zoom having a lasting impact on business travel.
The full chat featured in the latest episode of Peer-to-Peer Conversations this past week on Bloomberg and hosted by conversationalist, philanthropist, and Carlyle Group co-founder and co-chair David Rubenstein.
David joined us with a look at the world's changing labor landscape, the prospect of lasting inflation, and his top takeaways from his chat with Hilton's Chris Nassetta.
The hotel industry suffered probably as much as any industry, perhaps with the sole exception of the cruise industry, which pretty much shut down completely. The hotel industry dramatically saw occupancy go down. However, occupancy is now coming back mostly from travel and leisure, not as much from business, though business is coming back a bit. The stocks, though, of the travel and lodging companies are done quite well. I mean, right now, Hilton is at an all-time high. I think Marriott is near an all-time high as well. So the market is anticipating future growth. And the real challenge that the hotel companies have, and Chris Nassetta talked about this, is where do you get employees? A lot of employees went away, and now they got to hire them back at probably higher wages. And as a result, you're probably going to have some increases in the cost of rooms. In addition, should you provide all the services that you were providing before? People are used to having daily towel service and daily makeup service in their beds. Do you have to do that? Do you have to give free breakfasts every morning to some of your patrons? Some of these things are going to be looked at by companies like Hilton and others.
So what do you think, David, about the potential permanent shifts that we see on the other side of the pandemic when we do get to the other side of the pandemic when it comes to travel, leisure, and hospitality?
Well, I know from the business community, from my point of view, if I had to fly across the country for a one-hour meeting, I used to do it. Now I'm happy to do a Zoom. So I'm not traveling quite as much as I used to. I suspect it'll come back at some point. But in the you know, pre-pandemic, I would go to the Middle East or go to the Far East for a day or two and now come back. And now I'm a little more reluctant to do it because you can do so many things on Zoom. Obviously, you can't do everything on Zoom, and you have to have personal contact at some point. But I do think that business travel will be much slower to come back.
Hey, David, did Chris say anything about, well, you know, because we talk a lot more about more automation coming in, robotics. There's a lot more things we can do online with the hotel industry that we couldn't before. Does he say that they're making investments or helping, you know, out some of their team members by really introducing automation that maybe sticks with us going forward?
Well, sure. They are doing that. Right now, for example, rarely do people you know, need to check in anymore. You can just get your ticket online, more or less. Or now they're going to use face identification to some extent to check in. So I think technology is going to dramatically change the industry, and clearly the industry, you know, is a global industry. I mean, Hilton is all over the world, and they have thousands of hotels, and they have in different categories. That's a big change in the last 20 or 30 years. Used to be there was Hilton, there was Marriott. Now Hilton has about 15 different brands. Marriott has probably something similar. So you can have something for every different price point that you want.
Hey, one thing we were dying to ask you, David Rubenstein, and it has to do with a couple of stories that are among the most read on the Bloomberg. One has to do with Goldman talking about young U.S. workers are plotting early retirements. They're, you know, thinking about getting out a lot earlier. And then we've got another one on the Bloomberg Big Take. It's about the Great Resignation, about how we've had, more than 24 million from April to September here in the U.S. alone quitting their jobs. We're seeing it, though, as a global phenomenon. And in some countries, we've already seen it happening even pre-pandemic. What's going on? Why is everybody quitting? Why are younger folks saying, I've had it? Are we missing something? What do you make of this trend?
Well, my generation, basically, you after college or graduate school, you went to work and you worked until you were 65 or 70, and maybe some cases even longer than that. Younger people are saying, well, I can work out of my home a bit. Why do I need to work in the traditional way? And secondly, maybe I don't need to work quite as long. I can make a fair amount of money if I do well and retire at 55 or 60 or even 50. So the world is changing. The world always changes. I'm not surprised. The pandemic has really changed the way people look at the world. I know my own generation has looked at the world much differently because we're worried more about getting the COVID and getting to the point where we can survive this because of the age group. And more people who are older than me, even, I'm in my early 70s, are saying they don't want to work anymore either because they just want to retire and recognize that life might be easier if they just retired.
Are there concerns, though, about productivity if we see this?
Well, productivity, it generally increases because of technology. So technology tends to make productivity get much better, some countries better than others. Yeah, productivity is always a challenge, but as a general rule of thumb, productivity does increase even when you have fewer employees.
Well, what about, though, an economic or market rethink, David? Like, I do wonder if you're retiring early, or maybe you're saying, you know what, I don't need so much in my wardrobe, even if you've done well, like you just pare back. Are there implications that we need to be thinking about?
Well, sure. I mean, people probably don't need to buy. I used to buy a lot of business suits, probably don't need as many of them. I used to buy a lot of ties, probably don't need a lot of them. And people probably are going to just change their life a bit. You know, it's interesting that the Industrial Revolution changed the way we live or work over about a 100-year period of time. Mm-hmm. The internet maybe over a 25-year period of time. The smartphone over 7 years or so. And now, over just 1.5 years, we're changing the way we live and work because of a pandemic that was never anticipated. And whether that's a good thing or not, it's clearly here and it's a reality. And people are much different in the way they look at work. They don't view it as an obligation so much. If they don't enjoy it, they're not going to do it.
I wonder if technological innovation, though, has kept up with the worker attitudes. We're having a hard time in the United States finding long-haul truckers, but we're not seeing self-driving trucks at this point on roads.
Not yet.
It's a challenge for Amazon to keep employees. Incredibly high turnover, but, you know, they're not being replaced by robots at this point. So isn't there some concern or trepidation about the idea that productivity hasn't and technology hasn't caught up to worker attitudes?
Well, workers are have higher ambitions of what they want to do, and the kind of jobs you might get by working in a warehouse and fulfilling orders for Amazon may not be as intellectually challenging as what some people really wanted to do when they went to college or some kind of vocational training. Clearly, things are going to have to adjust. But in the end, I think the American workforce is pretty resilient, and I think we'll come back. We can't compete with the workforce in terms of cost in China or Asia, but we can, I think, do pretty good job in making productivity better than it has been. And clearly, technological leaders usually come from the United States.
Hey, David, your series of books, your trilogy, on leadership, historians really looking at the growth of this nation and how it's evolved and really talking with leaders as we constantly, as you say, these invention innovative cycles seem to be happening in right. less time here. How do you see, in terms of the next trends or the people that you think we really have got to keep an eye on that really are going to be determining maybe the future trajectory? And it can be politically as well as on a business and market front.
Well, in the business world, change is usually made, as it is in the political world, by people who are younger. Revolutions are not usually led by 70-year-old people. And as a general rule of thumb, business change is usually led by demand from people who are in their 20s or 30s. So how many people have now caught on with the kind of social media devices that really the young people really focused on and really helped generate? Same with computers and the same with other kinds of services that we now rely on. Many of these came from younger people. So I think it's a very good thing if boards of directors in companies would get younger people on them. I think it's a good idea for boards of trustees as well, nonprofits, to have more and more people on them who are younger. I rarely see on the boards that I serve people under the age of 40. But really, that's where the change is coming from, and probably it's not a bad idea to have younger people on these boards or in senior positions advising boards of directors or trustees.
Hey, David, let's talk markets here, because you've seen lots of market cycles throughout your career. Help us understand and put into context the one that we're seeing right now with the S&P 500 just continuing to grind higher and, the COVID variants still making their way around the world and concerns about growth.
If the markets got anything wrong initially when COVID came about, it was that the markets were going to be more resilient than they turned out than people thought. In other words, when we went through COVID, people thought, okay, the economy is going to collapse, and all of a sudden the market will collapse. But as it turns out, maybe because of federal intervention for sure, but because of federal support and other factors, the stock market actually has gone up. And in the private equity world that I operate in, markets have never been better. People are making staggering sums of money compared to what they did before. So it's very difficult to predict. Right now, I would say that the federal government is probably going to increase interest rates next year. That should have a somewhat impact on the market of probably reducing prices a bit. And I suspect inflation won't go away, so that might impede the market a bit. But I don't see any collapse in the near term. I don't see any kind of correction of any consequence. We might have a one-day, two-day blip because of something that happens, but a 10 or 15% market correction, I don't see that for an enduring period of time in the next year or so.
That's Carlyle Group co-founder and co-chairman David Rubenstein, also host of Peer-to-Peer Conversations on Bloomberg. He's got a bunch of books out about the conversations he's had with great leaders, historians. The latest one is called The American Experiment, Dialogues on a Dream. And that wraps up the first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Ahead in our next hour, a dispatch from the Bloomberg Sustainable Business Summit. Carol speaks with Revolution Chairman and CEO Steve Case, also with AppHarvest President David Lee, on what it takes to build a sustainable brand.
Plus NFTs, they are incredibly hot right now. So hot that one of America's top auction houses just raked in 9 figures on digital art. Yep, you heard that right. Later on, also Bloomberg Pursuits taking you inside the burgeoning world of luxury goods in the metaverse. I got to tell you something. I kind of want to own it and feel it.
Coming up next, our Bloomberg Investigations team reveals the ESG ratings process for an industry giant.
This is an unbelievable story, a deep dive into the world of ESG. More on the ESG mirage that's coming up next. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovec.
Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, including the exploding world of NFTs and how Christie's auction house got in on the action to the tune of a nine-figure haul.
Yeah, you heard that right. We're also talking luxury goods. They're going digital too. How the likes of Burberry, Gucci, and more, well, they are planting their flags in the old metaverse. Tim, I guess I could call it the new metaverse.
It's happening. Plus, venture capitalist Steve Case, co-founder, of course, of America Online, now chairman and CEO of Revolution. He stops by with AppHarvest president David Lee. They talk about building a sustainable brand.
First up this hour, look at a side of ESG investing that many of us are either misunderstanding or perhaps we're just looking the other way. We're simply choosing to ignore it.
I guess so, right? This story is called The ESG Mirage. It's incredible. Bloomberg News Projects and Investigations reporter Cam Simpson and some colleagues here at Bloomberg wrote it, and they talk about how sustainable investing is mostly about sustaining profits, or really looking at the company. It's explained through the lens of ratings giant MSCI. Cam joins us from London. So Cam, a deep dive. I can't imagine how long it took you guys to do this. Tell us what you set out to do and what you did specifically look into.
Yeah, thanks so much, Carol. I mean, we came into this year like a lot of people in, you know, who write about business and finance or anybody who pays attention to it, thinking about this thing called ESG, environmental and social and governance investing, and knowing that there was a lot of hype around it. I mean, it just completely exploded in terms of, you know, assets under management. And that can be a little bit squishy depending on who's doing the definition, but, you know, what's publicly visible are, you know, ETFs and other retail funds that just were going through the roof. I mean, BlackRock at the top of the list. And there's a lot of criticism. There's been a lot of criticism for a long time that this is not what it appears to be, and that this is just kind of marketing, and it really has nothing to do with saving the planet, which is how it's being marketed. I mean, it's marketed, you know, as we're investing in companies that have favorable practices on environmental practices and social practices, without anybody saying what that really is. And the foundation of this whole new cash machine for Wall Street, I mean, it is the fastest growing segment of the global financial services industry, are the ratings underneath it, right? Yeah. So there's a rating system that allows BlackRock and Vanguard and everybody else, you know, State Street, to say this fund is quote unquote sustainable.
Okay,
this
let's talk about that, because MSCI is a really big part of this feature.
They're indexing the world.
They're the whole thing.
Exactly. Talk about what MSCI is and what they've been doing.
Yeah, so MSCI has kind of, you know, had this happy existence for a long time as kind of a back office Wall Street company that nobody really ever talked about. They did well in the era of passive investing because they produce indexes for people who sell investments, and they press a button and a couple hundred thousand indexes go out a day from MSCI. And slowly over the last decade, they were building this, you know, ESG ratings business through acquisitions. I think it happened almost accidentally in the beginning, and then some people saw, well, maybe this will be a thing. In 2019, when it was clear that this stuff was really going to take off, they rebranded the company. The CEO, Henry Fernandez, pitched it on an analyst call, analysts who rate his stock, and he said, look, well, we've got a mission now, and our mission is better portfolios for a better world, you know, really grabbing onto the sustainable mantra, the sustainable marketing around ESG, and they really, really started pushing that. But they dominate the space of these ESG ratings completely and totally. Nobody else is even close. They, you know, Bloomberg Intelligence calculated at least 60% of the money in retail funds is in funds built on MSCI's ratings. And, you know, we put that to Henry Fernandez, and he said, no, that number's low. It's higher than that. So
Fernandez heads MSCI, has for a long time.
Yeah, no, he's the only chairman and CEO they've ever had.
What's interesting, Cam, is I remember early on talking about ESG as the money was starting to flow in and we were talking about it, and that we really did look at it from like, hey, folks, the reason we care about climate change, for a lot of reasons we cared about it, but is that it was going to impact companies and their financial picture. And that is really the tack that MSCI has stayed with. But at the same time, many investors are thinking, okay, I invest in this company because they are reducing their emissions, they're reducing their impact on the environment. But that's not the case. That's really the bottom line of what you found out.
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line is when you look at, we went through every ratings upgrade that MSCI gave to companies in the S&P 500 during this record of historic growth for investment. And what we discovered looking under the hood and going through all the ratings and building a data set was this has absolutely nothing to do with the impact of the companies on the world. Not absolute, virtually nothing, almost nothing. Incidentally, it might. But the lens that they use and the lens ESG uses in general is what is the impact of the world on the company? It's the exact opposite of what investors think it is. Investors think that they're investing in good environmental practices, which is how these are pitched by BlackRock and everybody else. But it's not. It's how those impacts on the world affect the company. Like, it's completely the opposite of what everybody thinks it is.
Cam, it is a must read, and I highly recommend. We'll put it out on our Twitter feed, but I highly recommend that everybody check it out. Our thanks to Bloomberg News Projects and Investigations reporter Cam Simpson. And as I said, check it out. It's in the latest issue of Bloomberg Businessweek. It is available on the terminal, on newsstands, and at businessweekandbloomberg.com. I love this story.
It's really good. And one thing we talk about a lot, Carol, is if there needs to be some sort of different type of measurement. We talk a lot about transparency.
Metrics, perhaps?
Yeah, the idea of metrics that actually move a company's stock when it comes to what impact it's actually having on the planet and the people who live on it.
Right. Accountability, like all of this, really matters. All right, you're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, some actual progress is being made in building companies that are not harming the environment and expanding the idea of what it means to be truly sustainable.
Venture capitalist and, of course, the co-founder of AOL, Steve Case, joining us along with the head of one of the companies that he's invested in, AppHarvest, David Lee. Lee from AppHarvest joining us as well. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
The Bloomberg Live Sustainable Business Summit took place this past week. It's an event that brings together global leaders, investors, all about driving innovation and scale and best practices in sustainable business and finance.
Carol hosted a panel with two executives intent on doing just that, and they're in the ag tech space. Steve Case, you know him, of course, for co-founding America Online. He's now chairman and CEO of Revolution. He took part in a discussion with AppHarvest president and board member David Lee.
AppHarvest went public this year. It's also a company that Revolution invested in through one of its three funds. As for Steve Case, he only expects more dollars to flow into similar ventures.
I think the broad trend in the last decade in terms of the growth and interest in sustainability in the last several years, a real acceleration of investment in ESG, I think bodes really well. I think the perception 10 or 15 years ago was this is sort of a good thing to do, but wasn't necessarily a profitable thing to do. That's clearly changed. Some of the most valuable companies now being created are focused on sustainability. AppHarvest obviously being one. We also backed Sweetgreen. I recently went public with a very, very strong focus on sustainability and even a board committee focused on ESG. We also backed TemperPack, which is trying to focus on sustainable packaging, rid the world of styrofoam, which is terrible for the environment, by using a better packaging. And a lot of big food companies like HelloFresh and Daily Harvest use it, as well as pharma companies. So it's identifying problems out there that need new solutions that are good business opportunities while also being much more sustainable in terms of what they're doing and the impact it will have on the planet. I think there's a rush to focus on these from the entrepreneurial sector, a rush to invest in these from obviously the investor sector, but also a rush from a customer standpoint, a consumer standpoint. They really want to do business with companies that care about the world and care about the planet and have a strategy and a real commitment to sustainability.
Are we being smart enough as an investment base, Steve, to give companies time? AppHarvest, you went public this year. It's been, I would say, a volatile IPO market. But I do wonder, Steve, like, are we thinking about that balance between we need to be more sustainable as a world, right? Otherwise, there ain't going to be anything left. So are we understanding enough? Are we sophisticated enough as investors to understand that there's got to be a balance to let these companies grow, to make their investments, and maybe at the risk of short-term financial performance, but longer-term, this makes sense because it's got to be where the world goes.
Yeah, every company is a little bit different, but you have to figure out what your time horizon is and make sure you're educating investors, whether you're a private company or a public company, on that. Sweetgreen, which started 14 years ago, has done that and it built up a significant business that's scaling quite nicely. AppHarvest started just 4 years ago, as I mentioned, and was able to go public and access the capital markets to dramatically expand what they're doing on the production side with new facilities, not just the initial one in Eastern Kentucky, but many others, and also invest heavily in technology, particularly robotic technology. So they were able to use that capital, and they educated the market at the time they went public that this really is something that will build significantly over the next decade. But we need access to the capital markets to be able to execute an ambitious plan to really build AppHarvest as a company and build it as a brand. And that's the path they're on right now.
David, what is it like the conversations you're having with investors like Steve, with others, now that you're public, a public company, in terms of what they want to see, what kind of transparency they want to see, though, to understand, hey, this is a true sustainable investment?
Well, one of the hallmarks, I think, in being public when you're interested in large global impact is every day you are educating the public investor. Every quarter, you have radical transparency, not just to what your financial results are, but frankly, the commitment we have to sustainability. You know, we have a high bar because we have gone to investors that are the most sophisticated in the world. With that access and capital comes the chance for us to radically speed up how many of these large technology-enabled greenhouses we can produce. For perspective, you know, our first farm in Eastern Kentucky is 2.8 million square feet, right? It has a water reservoir that allows us to use 90% less water, but that water reservoir is something like 50 Olympic swimming pools large. So the scale of the impact that, frankly, we need as a community means that we have to bear the radical bright light of being public. It has a great benefit, but companies have to be prepared every day, every quarter, to be scrutinized. And that is different than when a lot of these companies only could access the private capital markets. It is a great opportunity, but it has a real burden and cost to the team to make sure that they can operate to the rigor of the public markets.
Hey, David, what's more difficult, being a public company or dealing with kind of the infrastructure, the establishment of how we do agriculture right now, you know, dealing with kind of the old way and coming up against that?
That's a great question. I'll give you an example. You know, back in the early 2000s, I was running a food company, public company called Del Monte Foods. And, you know, back then we knew at the company level that climate change was a problem. You know, people were pulling out peach trees in California and planting nut trees because the climate couldn't serve it. That was 20 plus years ago. And what I would say today, the answer to your question is that there's so much more awareness by the consumer who is really demanding better food. You see it in all the great brands and companies, Sweetgreen that was mentioned already by Steve, but look at all the companies that have gone public in the last 10 years that are really dedicated to a better future for food. It's no longer the case that because consumers are demanding this, that staying in the shelter of being private is the easier answer. I actually think that the infrastructure that is being put in place is now part of the broader incumbent food industry. It's no longer us versus them. You know, we are in partnership with the largest retailers. We are in partnership with the largest supply chain providers for our greenhouses. And it's because we're trying to be part of the mainstream food industry. It's a big change from back in the day when I would largely ignore at Del Monte Foods some of these smaller, sustainably minded entrepreneurs. It can't be ignored anymore because consumers and investors are really demanding it.
And the other thing I'd add to that is, as we've seen in the last decade, a greater focus on sustainability and better access to the capital markets, whether they be at the private company level or the public company level. And that's actually made companies like AppHarvest possible. Early on, 10, 15 years ago, some of the initial investments in sustainability, climate tech, some other areas, a lot of those companies failed because they were big ideas that required significant capital and required a longer runway, a 10 plus year runway. And it was difficult for venture capitalists to back those companies.
That's Revolution Chairman and CEO Steve Case and AppHarvest President David Lee. You can catch Carol's entire conversation with them by heading to BloombergLive.com and searching Bloomberg Sustainable Business Summit.
Still to come on Bloomberg Business Week, you may not understand what they are or how they work, and yet millions of dollars are being thrown at NFTs. We're talking about non-fungible tokens.
The president of Christie's Americas on the auction house's $200 million 21st century evening sale. Yeah, you heard that right, $200 million, with these alternative assets as the centerpieces. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
Alternative asset prices have risen during the pandemic, and while pricey collectibles have long been a favorite of the wealthy, the future of high-end artwork could be really turned on its head, I feel like, and could be on the blockchain instead of hanging over your mantle.
Non-fungible tokens, or NFTs, while they've exploded in popularity, nowhere was that more evident than last month at a Christie's sale. It was dubbed the 21st Century Evening.
So it's interesting, as people are coming back to the auction houses to participate in auctions, we're now bidding on virtual pieces of work.
You'll get there. Yeah, you'll get there.
Oh, my head is spinning. Well, that night of that auction, buyers spent a total of $219 million on various works of art. It included nearly $29 million on a digital piece. It was called Human One. It was the first hybrid physical and digital artwork by NFT artist Beeple.
The president of Christie's Americas, Bonnie Brennan, stopped by to explain why the auction house got in on the digital art craze.
Our first question was, what was an NFT? You know, in the last, since March of this past year, we've all been learning in real time. And as you said, the NFTs have really taken the art world by storm. We're particularly proud of having sort of ushered in this global rush to digital art back in March, and we sold the Beeple for $69 million. And now to date, if you can believe it, we've sold over 75 NFTs for more than $136 million. So it is an important new part of our market. It's had a great impact on the entire auction business and certainly our business here.
I have to just tell you, if you're not watching on YouTube, Carol's mouth is just agape because you don't remember,
catching
you
flies.
Remember Beeple.
I remember Beeple.
Yeah, back in March, 69. That was sort
that
of,
was so
I think
yesterday.
That was,
no, it
but
so
I think
yesterday.
It was like a real inflection point. And,
totally.
And Bonnie, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but is this something that you truly believe has staying power, or is this a fad?
You know, I think it has staying power. We've seen great curiosity from our established buyers, Tim. We've tried to introduce NFTs into a variety of categories like photography and design, and it's been met with great interest. We've also introduced NFTs into new markets, into our sales rooms in Hong Kong and in London. And I'll tell you, this fall, I stood in the galleries and I had a number of traditional, very serious established collectors say, take me to the Beeple. This fall, we had a hybrid work. It was the first sort of digital/physical work that Beeple had done called Human One. And all of our clients who regularly buy Picassos and Old Masters really wanted to see that work. And I think they're becoming more fluent about NFTs, and they're starting to see how NFTs might fit into their collections of, again, more, you know, what they're expected, the art you'd expect to see.
See it and buy it, or just see it, Bonnie? Your established collectors who are used to buying Klimts and Picassos and you name it.
No, definitely they're participating, Carol. They are there and they are driving some of the prices that we've seen. It's been nice. We've had crossover both ways. Traditional collectors bidding on the NFTs, but we've also, the best part about NFTs, it has introduced 400 new clients to Christie's, and about a quarter of those have gone on to buy works by artists like Warhol and Picasso.
Bonnie, you guys more than anybody understand, though, the value of something and the retention of that value. And so what's going to be more valuable longer term? And I'm stealing a headline from the New York Times earlier this year over the summer. They recently asked a painting or an NFT of it, which will be more valuable, which will be longer term?
I think, you know, as always, we have to listen to our market. Our market tells us what they value. And right now there's an equal interest and passion and a sense of value being placed on these NFTs. I mean, $69 million, it's right up there. It it leads in the sales of any works of art ever sold at auction. So I think that's an answer. We don't have the answer to that, but I think they will play side by side for a long time.
I'll trade you a JPEG of a Picasso for a real Picasso.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. Well, the thing is, this is, I got to tell you, the conversations we have in our newsroom around this, because if it's digital, it can be copied ultimately, right?
Well, that's the beauty of NFTs, is that there really is, it's so much grounded in authenticity. We have, for example, we have a sale going on we've just announced with OpenSea. OpenSea is the world's leading NFT marketplace, and that sale is going to allow collectors to purchase the NFTs via the Ethereum blockchain, and that will assure, yes, you can look at the images and you can share the visual representation of the NFT, but Carol, if you were to buy that NFT on that OpenSea sale, that blockchain, you would be the only owner of that work of art,
but,
and that really locks in that ownership.
But you can do a digital copy, right? So somebody else could do a digital copy. Am I missing something?
You are.
Okay.
Well, you could certainly have it. You know, that's where you and all three of us could print out a picture of the Beeple that sold in March, but only the owner owns the actual code.
That's Bonnie Brennan, president of Christie's Americas, on the art of the NFTs.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, we know you like the finer things in life. I mean, come on, who doesn't? So what exactly does luxury look like in the metaverse?
That's a question. Our Bloomberg Pursuits team tells us which brands are building the digital department store of your dreams. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
So we've talked about NFTs and the blockchain being used for works of art. So what about for luxury goods as well? We're going to broaden out the discussion to include every futurist's favorite topic. We are talking about the metaverse.
Well, the top shelf brands that you know and love, they're actually starting to test the waters in what they hope could become a new type of digital marketplace. Our Bloomberg Pursuits editor, Chris Rouser, joins us now. Chris, so you, in the Pursuits section this week, you have a feature about a company that actually sells luxury digital goods in the metaverse. And hey, guess what? Those margins are pretty good.
Yeah. When no one's stitching anything, suddenly the margins look really great.
It's out of control. I mean, this has to be the top, Carol, right? Like, we have to look back on this, and we're talking about the idea of paying big bucks for something that, to a lot of people, I think they'd argue doesn't actually exist.
Mm-hmm. All right, so what's going on here, Chris?
So, you know, what's really interesting is that luxury brands are famously really slow on catching up to the internet and to the digital world. They were very slow to have e-commerce. They were very slow to have websites, even in the mid-2000s, Prada didn't have a website. And now they're really tiptoeing
You talk about selling stuff, like real goods online.
Yeah, just like you want to buy a bag online. You couldn't do it. And now they're selling stuff that doesn't even really exist in the metaverse. And they're selling them, like Balenciaga is in Fortnite, Gucci is in Roblox, on these metaverses, which you can only imagine someone trying to explain to a bunch of like executives in Italy or Paris, like what all this stuff is. So the trend is being led by some really interesting innovators who are making basically digital department stores, and they're selling bags and they're selling clothes to people to wear in video games and in virtual platforms, social media platforms, and people are spending real money on it.
So, I mean, like, what do you mean real money? Like, are you buying a Birkin bag?
So Hermes is not quite yet there. Okay, I expect them to be later on it. But people are spending $4,000 on a Gucci bag, which is more than that bag actually costs in real life.
You can't put anything in that bag and actually go out to dinner with it, can you?
Well, you can go out to dinner in a metaverse. You can go to your apartment, your penthouse that you own in a metaverse.
Carol is so lost.
So this
Carol,
is for, this
remember
is for the,
Sim City?
Yeah.
Remember Sim Tower?
This is for gamers, right?
Yeah, so the root of it...
I feel like the gaming society.
This feels new because a lot of people are learning about it now, but the root of wearing clothes, like skins, or owning objects that belong to you and have to be authentic to you, is the roots are very deep in gaming. And people take what they look like and their avatars very seriously. And it was sort of blasted into the mainstream when Facebook made its announcement that it's reimagining itself as Meta. And Mark Zuckerberg made this video where he was changing clothes on his avatar. He was... he had an apartment that he filled with his stuff, and he tried to explain how we're in the future, we're going to have our own personal spaces, what we look like matters, and we're going to interact in these virtual worlds.
You know what Mark Zuckerberg also has, though? He has like a huge beachfront property in Kauai that exists in the real world.
That's true.
You mean it's actually physical?
It's actually physically there. And like,
so
you
retro.
Can go hang. Yeah, I know, so retro. Hey, talk about the dematerialized, though, because they're a big part of this.
So the dematerialized is a British started company, and they call themselves the digital department store of your dreams. And basically what they do is they work with artists to create limited edition products like an outfit or a bag. They do them in ranges of one to about 150 usually. And they do drops like an Air Jordan sneaker drop, and people race to buy the clothes. And again, you can't wear the clothes in real life. You can wear them on the platforms that they partner with, like VR Chat, which is a virtual reality, a social world. And it's become quite popular, and they always sell out.
Who are these people? And I feel like these are the people that President Xi over in China is like, okay, we have to stop this because they have so much money to spend on this stuff. Like, I don't get it, Chris.
Part of why I think it's not easy to wrap your mind around is because a lot of the people who are doing this are crypto investors. And
okay.
For them, the money is not, it's not real the way that sort of maybe money is to me or you. And so speculation.
Pays the bills for me.
Yeah, speculation and having fun in these virtual worlds is a little detached from normal currency. And these are the people who are really fueling the enthusiasm for buying this stuff, because, you know, this kind of thing matters to them and it's cool.
So why do the big brand names, do they just want to be part of the conversation? Like, it's funny that you, when I was reading this, I had put on my desk a story that came out this week about Ralph Lauren, latest brand selling digital wares on Roblox. And I'm like, wait, what's Roblox? What is going on? So is it because they want to make sure they're part of this conversation? They don't at least miss a trend forever, how long it stays?
So fashion is, after art, like fashion is probably the industry that is the most forward thinking about this, and it's huge upside for them because they can mint clothes, they can verify authenticity by attaching their clothes to an NFT. You know, authenticity has been a huge problem for fashion brands. People, there's a lot of knockoffs out there. And then they can make outfits that they don't actually have to sew. And so it's a huge margin because people will pay real money to wear these things in the metaverse or in the future, maybe in an augmented reality world where we're all wearing glasses and we look around and, you know, I'm just wearing sweatsuits, but then you look at me with your augmented reality glasses and I'm wearing a fabulous cape.
Because I know you like
only capes for me in the future.
In the metaverse.
And because I know you like watches, you could just have like 10 up your arm.
Yeah, exactly. And then and you can also go back into your archives and you could re-release old things that you designed 50 years ago. You can bring them back and release them exclusively. You don't have to go through all the production. And, you know, there's just a ton of, and then also you can build in resale value. So in the NFT, in the contract, you can have it so that if someone sells, you know, this Gucci bag to somebody else, you get 5% of that sale. And resale is a huge issue that's going on in the fashion industry that the original brands are not getting any money back.
But people, you don't actually get the Gucci bag.
Yeah, let me just say something. Just for people who can't see Carol's face right now, because you're listening to this, what you can tell by looking at her face is there are none of these NFTs are on her holiday shopping list.
But, you know, I do wonder if it's a great lesson for all of us. Tim, you and I talk about just how much stuff we have and how we're tired of it. And so many people have had these conversations coming off the pandemic
of
like,
you know what? I also spend too much time online, so I don't want to spend. Yeah, I sound like such a curmudgeon here, but it's not hitting me yet. I'll be honest.
But what about the idea of so much of this week, our weekend show, we're talking about the ESG space and sustainability. Mm-hmm. And I do think about Chris. I think about my immigrant grandparents. They had a few good suits, a few pairs of shoes. Like, I do wonder if we're thinking about the impact of all of the stuff that we have and the impact it has on the environment. Is this a way to some extent of kind of dealing with that?
Yes. There's a few ways that this could actually help address oversupply in the fashion industry, which is a huge problem. There's like a, you know, at the end of every season, there's tons of discounting, and then a lot of clothes just ends up getting destroyed. It's a huge waste.
Right.
So the futurists who are looking at this are looking far into the future when they can train users to really get into this system of fashion. But imagine if you look at a virtual runway that has all these outfits and you're a consumer and you have your avatar and it has all your sizes and you know that you can try on clothes with your avatar, you can watch a fashion show, order the looks you like, you know it'll fit you, and then that company never even has to make the clothes until you order it, as opposed to filling you know, however many Zaras there are in the world, millions maybe, with clothes for everyone to try on, which will never be end up being purchased, and then they just end up being waste. Mm-hmm. Eventually, people are predicting that this could address that kind of oversupply.
It's crazy. And I'm also thinking about, all right, let's go on to something else that's in the magazine, because I think it's interesting, because it's another big theme that we're talking about.
But it's the real world.
It is.
It's not the metaverse.
And it's something you and I talk about. You know, there's the great resignation going on. A lot of people are quitting their jobs. We are not. We're all at work.
Somehow we're still here.
We are. So are we addicted to work? There's a book out about this.
Yeah, so these two journalists, Charlie Wurzel and Anne Helen Peterson, who has a very popular newsletter that all my friends are addicted to, basically quit their or left their workplaces in New York during the pandemic and went to live in Montana. And they thought, okay, you know, all the time that we spent commuting and stuff, we're going to switch that up and we're going to go skiing and hiking. And that didn't turn out to be the case. They just filled all that extra time with work.
Yeah. And, including writing a book.
Yeah, including writing a book, which like exactly. Maybe more productive work. And so they went and they looked at sort of the flaws we have in the American work system, because actually in some European countries with more efficiency, people use that time for leisure. But Americans, and actually the Chinese turns out, we're not programmed that way. And so, you know, because more of us have been working remotely, they looked at all this and they saw all these complicated trends. One they call toxic individualism, which is like sort of everyone's competing with each other
to
show up how much they work. And then there's hierarchies where if you're not in the office, maybe it doesn't look like you're working as hard as the people who are in the office. So if you're working from home, you work more hours to seem more productive. It's created all these structural issues that, you know, still need to be solved.
That's interesting to me about hybrid, because we could talk about hybrid being the solution, but I do think that that's such a great point, that are those that don't come to the office disadvantaged ultimately. And so I think that's a really, really important point. So let's talk about, first of all, Hannah Elliott. I love when she writes something and about her experience, and she talks about Mercedes Complete EV.
So it's their first electric sedan, and it's about $100,000, and Hannah put it through the most rigorous test that she possibly could. She drove it over Thanksgiving week when all of her family came to visit. So she picked them up at the airport, and you know, she drove around, she took them on tours, and then when she was at the in the grocery store parking lot at a Gelson's, suddenly when she was like racing to get stuff on Thanksgiving morning, suddenly she said, wait a minute, I've had this car several days and I forgot to charge it. And so she's like, oh no, she gets back to her car, she's like, it's going to be out of charge, and she still had 100 miles left.
Our thanks to Bloomberg Pursuits editor Chris Rauser for joining us with a look at the latest and greatest in the section from this week's issue.
And that wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Be sure to tune into Bloomberg Business Week Monday through Friday. It starts at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio.
You can also watch our daily broadcast on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News.
Also, check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast. You can find it at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Business Week, we're available on newsstands now at Bloomberg.com, Businessweek.com. Comment on the Bloomberg Terminal.
You can also see me on Bloomberg Quick Take. It's available on Bloomberg.com/QT and streaming platforms like Roku, Apple TV, Samsung TV, and more. Have a great weekend.
Make some pizza. Just going to say that. This is Bloomberg.
Attention campers. The new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.